Total Tuscany Podcast, episode 58. Ciao, and welcome to another edition of the Total Tuscany Podcast. I'm Travis Justice, joined once again by co-publisher of TotalTuscany.com, Mr. Pat Capagna. Hello, Pat.
Travis, great to be back in the chair.
You know, it's interesting. I was looking before we recorded today's interview that we have not done a recording of the podcast since like last July. Of course, we're not in the studio as frequent as we have been in the past, but it doesn't mean that our love and affection for all things Tuscany and really Italy, for that matter, has not changed that much.
No, not at all. It's just life's busy.
It really is. I was lucky enough, of course, we did a Total Tuscany experience in October of 2017, and then my wife and I were in Italy, in Florence, in early December, which, by the way, I think I should just do a podcast with you on Christmas season in Florence, because it was really a unique time. We'd been in the spring, early spring. We've gone in the fall. I haven't done the summer yet, and I'm not really interested in the tourist crowds and the heat of Italy that takes place. But this was the first time that we went for Christmas season. The Christmas market was open in the Santa Croce, and we just had a nice little hotel in Florence, and it was awesome. And I'm sorry you didn't get to go with us. You know, I asked you to go, but you turned me down.
It's painful. Painful to hear this.
And just to let everybody know, so Pat and I, we do, our families, or at least our wives, we try to travel at the exact same time. We want to do things together. We're kind of joined at the hip. We're good friends that way. And the truth is, we're great travel companions. And if you can find a great travel companion, that means the world when you take trips. Because you want to take trips with those people all the time, because you have so much in common when you travel. Pat wasn't able to go with us this time, so we have friendly competitions where I would just text him during my trip as he was at work, and I would send him pictures, and I think I may have annoyed you a little bit in December.
Not at all. I was living vicariously, and when I return in the spring of this year, I'll with my family, I will similarly let you live vicariously through me. As a little segue here, we have planned an interview with Andrew Cotto, an author, an academic, and somebody who has a similar obsession, maybe. Maybe that's too wrong of a term.
No, I think because Italy and Tuscany in particular, it does become an obsession. It doesn't happen with everybody, right? I mean, but sometimes a region or a place just really gets into your blood. I mean, how many times have you asked? I mean, how many times have we gone? Several times now, people are like, you guys keep going back to the same place. That's boring. I'm like, well, it may be boring to you, but it's rejuvenation for me. It's therapeutic for me. It's almost religious for me. And Andrew's book, his latest book, Cucina Tipica, An Italian Adventure, tells the fictional story, but there's a lot of nonfiction in there because he's based on some of his friends and people he knows in Italy. Really describes what his therapy is, and it's food.
Exactly, I'm looking forward to reading the book because he is looking at this the same way you and I have experienced, and it's interesting to see it from a male perspective.
Which doesn't happen that often. Right, most of the Tuscany perspectives are female. This is the male perspective of Tuscany. And really, no disrespect to any of our previous guests on this podcast, but this really is one of our favorite interviews. Maybe it's just because we have that connection with Andrew. Andrew Cotto joins us on the Total Tuscany Podcast. Andrew, I got to be honest with you, of all the podcasts we've done, and this is the 58th in the series of the Total Tuscany Podcast, you are the first male author that we've had that ran away to Italy. Why don't more men run away to Italy?
I wish I knew. I mean, I don't understand. I don't know where men run away to. Maybe it's just about they don't want to run away as much. But
oh, yes, we do.
Something we do. I don't know where they go. Vegas? I don't know. Thailand. I'm not sure what it is, you know, about Italy that's less of appeal to men. I can't understand it. I know that when I travel there with my friends, they all love it. You know, when they come visit with me, it's so gender neutral from my perspective. But there must be something about it, you know, that's I think maybe it's the natural beauty I don't know. No. I mean, I'm not complaining about it because I'm happy to be one of few men amongst lots of women.
So before we dive into your book, and we're going to talk a lot about that, take us through a journey of how you first ended up in Italy and Tuscany in particular.
Yeah, I'm Italian American, you know, from a big New York family, and I grew up, you know, with all the trappings of Italian Americana, and I was into them. You know, the food in particular was my favorite part of it. But as I got older and, you know, entered the workforce and had a pretty, you know, generous expense account, I started getting into really good food here in New York City. So I was out a lot eating and drinking, and, you know, in the finer establishments, including some pretty sophisticated Italian places. And I developed a real love of Italy as a country, not as, you know, the descendants of immigrants necessarily, but just as what they were doing in Italy, particularly central Italy and to the north, as opposed to my family being from Sicily. I went on a trip there, my first vacation to Italy. I was in my early 30s. I'd actually won a contest at work where they awarded a free cruise to the winner of the sales contest, and I didn't want to go on a cruise. I'm not into, you know, boats and floating buffets and tiny rooms and, you know, excursions. So I said, can I just take that money you would have spent on the cruise and let me do what I want with it? And they were like, sure, knock yourself out. So I took the money and my wife and I went to Italy. I really, really, you know, first class trip from Venice, Florence, and Rome. And we had a couple of days in Venice, which I loved. Then we were in Florence, right above the hotel, right in the Arno. I think it's the Piazza Ognissanti. There, it's like a Westin hotel, I think. It's a really glamorous hotel. We had a terrace over the Arno, and we were going through some Prosecco, and I was looking around. I just felt a way that I hadn't felt ever in my life. Like I belonged there, like I was from there, though I'd only been there for a couple of days. And I said to my wife, well, we have to live here. And she thought I was being absurd and silly and whatever. And you know, 2 years later, we were living there. We came home. I started thinking to myself about ways to make it a reality. I started phasing out my career. We owned property, which I was able to sublet in Brooklyn, and it just all made sense. By the time we got over there, we had a daughter, and my wife was happy to spend time with her away from home and under our own auspices, and it was just amazing. So we rented a barn in the hills south of Florence, right in the very tip of Chianti country, in a comune called Bagno Ripoli, which is not particularly well-traveled by tourists, so it had that real Italian immersion feeling. You know, very few people spoke English, so thank God we had some friends. We had some expat friends we made and some other people who spoke English, but my fledgling Italian was able to get us through, and it developed rapidly as a matter of survival. So there was that experience for 1 year, and we came home. When we were there, I wrote my first novel. And I sort of launched my career as a novelist and a journalist and eventually an academic.
Andrew, Travis and I were talking about how we're living vicariously through your experiences. How did that first year in Italy, how did that exceed your expectations? And what kind of challenges did you have in that year that you weren't really expecting?
Well, the things that the aspects that exceeded my expectations were many. I just knew I loved it there and was so eager to be daring. And you know, people thought we were crazy for doing this. And I loved all that challenge of it. And I was up for it. And it was immediate in its reciprocation of my hopes, because it was just a spectacular place to visit. But to live there is something totally different. My routine was so prosaic but spectacular. It was just getting up every morning and walking down to the village and picking up some products for us for that day. You know, I became very close friends with the butcher who's you know, three times my age. He was in his, I think, his 70s then. And we somehow became the closest friends, and we made friends around the village and in town, and everything was just so rewarding, you know, just to live that life, you know, that slow life. I know it seems cliche, of Italy, without having to worry about how many more days we have left, when we going home, and, you know, then that everyday component, which was made every day just so special, also sort of buttressed by the fact that we could just go anywhere. We'd take excursions to the coast or down to Rome or east into Umbria or Le Marche up to Piedmont. We were doing all these trips around, and then those trips became outside of Italy too. We were Amsterdam and Madrid, so we had all this access to Europe, And on a macro sense, but on a micro sense, we were just having this amazing everyday life. You know, the food was so, every meal was tasted exceptional. We paired it with great wines, and it was also affordable too. One of the things that makes me happy about being in Italy is that you can eat and drink really well and stay too. But like the food is so important to me, and the wine, and you're going to the grocery store and you're getting Chianti Classico Reservas for $4 a bottle. You know, we're in New York. That's $35 a bottle. So you can't do it every day. So like having access to spectacular quality of life products that matter to me, you know, what I eat and drink at such a reasonable, ridiculous price was just such a treat. You know, so not being a tourist and experiencing it as not as a tourist was and how different that is made it the most spectacular to me. Then there's the big access to everything else that's around there, which is so beautiful. And we took trips into France, and I could go on and on, and maybe I will. The hard part, I guess, was, I'm trying to think of the hard part. I had to be fair. Winter was hard. You know, once the autumn passed, you know, the harvest season passed, which was my favorite part of the whole experience. We got there in September, so we were sort of just ahead of the harvest, and we lived through the harvest, all the sagras, all the festivals, you know, we went to. It was just, I was just couldn't be happier. It was, you know, it was a dream. Then the rainy season set in, and it got a little bit glum. You know, it was tough when it rained every single day, and you know, which limited our ability to do things that were exciting, and it felt like it was. You can feel displaced a little bit and a little bit lonely when you're an expat. I know that it's easy to romanticize the experience. You know, my wife was certainly missing her family, and we had a little girl who was growing up without you know access to her family and seeing her grandparents on a regular basis and our friends. So there was that, but you know, for me, it's a small takeaway from the overall you know benefits, which were just you know spectacular.
So how old were you when you did this with your wife and your child, and did you go over there with the sole purpose of it was going to be 1 year, or did you think at the time I'm going to stay the rest of my life here? What was the game plan at that point?
I think I was 34 when we got there. I was 33, 34. And it was definitely for the schedule was for 1 year. I wasn't ready at that point to I couldn't have made it work. I mean, to stay in Italy would have been you know problematic for us from a legality standpoint. But I didn't have interest in being there longer than a year. What I really wanted to do was spend a year in a place as a writer and eventually an academic, and that's where I wanted to do it. I didn't harbor any desire never to return to America. I mean, I don't have the expat, or I didn't have the expat. I might have it now. I didn't have the expat ambition. I just wanted to do it, you know, for longer than your typical vacation, and it was definitely longer than your typical vacation. I mean, so our expectation was in place from the get-go, just to make it a year. I think that helped too. You know, I think the anxiety would have been larger had we, you know, had to reinvent ourselves as Italians living in America, Americans living in Italy forever. That has a different sort of shape to it than knowing that you know at the end of the year we're returning. So I think that helped us with our comfort too.
Andrew Cotto joins us. He's an author. He's an academic. His new book, which was released in October, is The Italian Adventure, and it's Cucina Tipica, right? Is that what I'm saying? Cucina Tipica,
yeah.
The Italian Adventure, and which means typical food or typical kitchen. Am I right in the translation there?
Yeah, the translation isn't exact, but it kind of reminds me of like home cooking, the signs you might see in the American South. You know, home cooking available here, and you sort of know by that reference that they're making the whatever they make around that area, the specialty. So in Italy, you see lots of signs for cucina tipica, which means the regional cuisine. Like in Tuscan, cucina tipica is the things we associate with Tuscan cuisine. I love the name. I think it's a pretty sounding name, but I also had to tack on that an Italian Adventure subtitle so people knew what we were talking about here.
Isn't it amazing, though, how much food binds us? I think if there's one thing, I know religion can bind some people, or there's other things in a culture, but I think what binds people just over conversation, anything, it's food.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And it is kind of like a religion, not to be, you know, Not to equate it necessarily with something that profound for some people, but for me and I think folks like you too and lots of people, obviously, you know, food has that sort of that aspect to it which is bigger than just sustenance. Now that's what I'm trying to get at in the book. You know, food's a part of the book for sure, and lots of novels and movies where food is there. It's celebrated in its splendor. Oh, look at this next course. Oh my goodness, right? Oh, this tastes so good. You know, eat, pray, love. She's like eating a gelato and it seems like orgasmic. And I get all that. And I had that experience too, but it's bigger. I think it has a more profound impact on our soul than we give it credit for. I mean, I think there's a real sense of wellness that comes from eating well and enjoying food with other people. It's bigger than just filling your stomach and moving on so you have the energy to do your tasks. To me, it's a regular, you know, immersion in something that is so satisfying and so validating about life. And we make this food. It comes from the earth and we create it and we cook it and we share it. And that's profound. I mean, I don't want to get too heady about it, but I mean, think about all the wonderful things that happen over meals and all the wonderful things that could happen over meals. I mean, you want world peace, man. Just have a buffet, have a big, huge, you know, party, you know, everyone at the table together eating and drinking. Well, I think by the time it's over, there'll be something good coming out of it.
There is something to be said for that. I mean, I'll use an example, like two examples recently. Pat and our wives last week ended up in a restaurant. We're the only people there. We ended up staying for 2.5 hours. We'd have 3 bottles of wine, you know, three pizzas, you know, a whole bunch. Then last night, I went to a wake or a funeral, and I saw a couple that we had actually gone to Italy with a year ago, and they're like, come over to the house and have a bottle of wine with us. They still had some left over from Chianti. And they got out all the meats and cheeses. We just sat around a table. Yep. And that was just by happenstance. And you're like, this is what it's all about. It really is.
It is. I mean, what is more enjoyable than that? You're so in the moment. I mean, there's things that might be more fantastic, you know, like, you know, like exciting and oh my goodness, but like just that moment where you're sitting with people, enjoying each other's company, enjoying something together, you know, that's so amazing, like really good food and good wine. It there's nothing. I mean, my favorite day of the year or days of the year are Easter and Thanksgiving, because we have our house is full and we have tons of food and tons of wine and all this time together, and that's just what I want. And if you could do that on a regular basis.
It's amazing.
I miss the thing about my childhood I missed the most was Sundays at my grandmother's. We were there every Sunday, you know, for lunch, which was like 8 hours. You know, we get there as soon as everyone finished church, you go right over there, and we were there until dark, and it was just magical.
Andrew, it's the same thing with my growing up. We're Sicilian Americans, and so when you describe your grandmother's place, I was there too. I'm just curious. We've interviewed so many people, and for some people, it's the connection with Italy and Tuscany is the art and the architecture. But through all of those interviews and all the people we've met, the food is the critical component. And I see from your work, you've interwoven that in all of your work. How did that manifest itself in Cucina Tipica? How did you bring that out in that book?
That's a great question, Pat. I didn't intentionally set out to use food as sort of a motif in my work. My three novels all have are of different genres. One's a coming of age story, one's a noir, and then this book is sort of upmarket, you know, travel fiction, I guess. But the recurring theme in them all is food. You know, in my first novel, The Domino Effect, the coming of age novel, the kids from Queens, he's from an Italian American family, and there's a lot of scenes in that where, you know, important things happen while they're eating food. In fact, you know, the sandwiches are the reconnection of their relationship. In my second novel, the noir, the protagonist is a chef. He's not a detective. He's a chef, and he works at a African American restaurant in Brooklyn as an Italian American. And he sort of melds the menu between soul food and Italian food, and it's bigger than just the menu. It's the way he connects with the community. And after that novel was done, I started getting, you know, commentary about, you know, hey, you write food really well in your fiction. And my agent was like, you have to write, you know, something that has even more food than you've done in the past and really make it a focus of it. And that's where Cucina Tipica was really born from. That idea, like, okay, I need something really immersed in food, and there's no better way for me to do that than take my characters over to Italy and have them, you know, chase the food experience.
You know, for how many times you've been there, how many times we've been there, a lot of people come to us for advice, say, hey, where should I go? What should we do? And we have – what I found is – you tell me if you think this is bad advice I give. I say, here's where we go typically, But I'm like, explore on your own, because there's so many places I have not seen, I have not visited. And that if you see a place that looks like fascinating, go in it, try it, because, yeah, you may not know anything about it, but you might be pleasantly surprised. So every time we go back, and I was just there in December, Pat's going to go in April, I just try to go to new places I've never been, because I don't need to have something recommended, that you can find amazing food almost anywhere you go.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think it's the kind of knowledge you acquire once you've been there enough times. You don't need travel guides for Italy. I mean, maybe for art, I don't know. But like to eat well there, that's what makes it so magical, is that you don't have to have pick this place over that place, because they're all pretty similar. I mean, they're all similar in their fact that they make exquisite foods. And I mean, and of course, drink the local wine and eat the local food. I mean, just staying at an agriturismo and eating the food that they make there, if they're cooking, is going to be the best meal you're going to get. So I don't like to send people, down on paths trying to find this place or that place, especially because they might not meet their expectation. You don't know what I'm always leery of recommending places to anyone anywhere, because you put it in their head, here's the place to go, and they start, romanticizing what it's going to be like, and then expectations are so rarely met because it's not what they imagined. I mean, so that kind of experience is not one that I cherish. I like just finding the place that it's time to eat, look around, where's the closest place that looks normal, that looks decent, let's go there. And chances are you're going to find something that works, and it works within the milieu of where you are. I mean, when you're in Italy, you're not supposed to go trying to find the destination restaurant. I mean, you're just finding the place that's closest to where you are when it's time to eat.
The only tourist stop I think I really, really recommend in Tuscany is I do tell people to go to Dario Cecchini's place, because you, and especially if Dario's there, you will not be disappointed by the presentation.
No. I had my 50th birthday party there.
No, really?
Yeah.
I'm so jealous.
We're friends. When we lived there, we were in his shop once a week, because it was like our number one place to bring people who were visiting us. And this, when we lived there, he was really well known, but he wasn't the megastar that he became. And he was the same. He's the same person. Him and I are friends. And in fact, I just ran into him in a restaurant in New York about a month ago. He was there. There's a restaurant. There's a winemaker from Montefiore who has a couple restaurants here in New York. He just opened a Cingali restaurant. It's called Ristoro del Cingali.
Oh, really?
And it's all Cingali on the menu. They have other stuff too, but there's Cingali rack of Cingali. There's ragu, of course. And I went. I heard that it was opening. I was like, I gotta go. I went with a couple of friends, and there's Dario.
That's Dario's been on this podcast before. It was one of our most enjoyable podcasts, and he didn't speak a word of English. So his wife, it's the only one we had to translate. So his wife had to translate, who's American, and it's still besides you, of course, is one of our favorite podcasts.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Dario's one. I'm number two at this point.
Yeah, I think that's the way it works.
Yeah, I don't think I'm gonna usurp him. No, I find him to be just the essence. I also had my 40th birthday party at his place.
Okay, now so you're pissing me off.
Yeah, it was. And the one that my 40th was just me and a friend traveling together. It was two of us. This one last summer, I had 17 people there. We had that big table in the front, right in the street, and it was just amazing. And yes, the food is great. But it's him too. I mean, he is such a unique, authentic character that really embodies what it is to adore, the offerings of Italy. I mean, he cherishes everyday stuff, and he never gets tired of it. His enthusiasm never wanes. He looks exactly the same, for God's sakes. I think the magic to not aging is eating a lot of meat from Tuscany.
So, Andrew, did you weave any of those real life characters into your book?
Yeah, and speaking of Dario, there's a scene set in his restaurant, though I couldn't make it Dario because it was just too obvious, right? The need I had for that scene was there to be sort of like a young Dario, an up-and-coming butcher who's becoming famous. So I couldn't use Dario because he's already famous, and the novel's set in real time. So I used sort of this butcher of Panzano, who has a butcher shop and just opened a restaurant, but he's young and he's an actor. You know, Dario was a veterinarian, I think, before he became took over the butcher shop.
Yep.
So it's like a fledgling actor type who has to go back to his family's butcher shop, and he's like really good looking, and he creates a conflict with the main character and his fiance. But it's set in the shop in Panzano, so I sort of borrowed the setting and aspects of it. But I had to take Dario out because Dario is too huge. I do use Fabio Picchi. You know him from Florence?
I do not.
Fabio Picchi owns the Cibreo sort of franchise. So there's up in I forgot the neighborhood, but sort of near Piazza Beccaria. Beccaria, there's a neighborhood where Cibreo has a bunch of restaurants. Cibreo, like Cibreo itself, is like considered the best Florence restaurant, or among the best. He also has a couple of cafes and I think a pizzeria. But he also has this place called Il Teatro del Sale, the Theater of Salt, where he and his wife, who is Maria Cassi, she's like one of Florence's, certainly in Italy's, most known performers. She's sort of like a Lucille Ball type, you know, a one-woman show who does these performances. She's amazing. And they own this Il Teatro del Sale, where they have a buffet, actually, which is really rare for Italy, but they do this amazing buffet. It feels like theater. You can see the cooks making all the food behind a partition, and then they bring it out through the window, and they just put it and they scream it out. You know, whatever the next course is, they'll yell it out, and people go up there. It can be a little bit dangerous because Italians don't know how to do buffets. You know, when someone they don't do the buffet there in Italy, really. So when there's food put on a table that they have to get it themselves, it comes like a cattle call kind of, and people are just bumping into each other and trying to get to the food if it's really crowded. But regardless, it's a beautiful room. It's an old monastery that they converted into this amazing theater of food and art. And so you go there and you eat, and then someone performs. Often it's Maria, if you're lucky. She'll do her one-woman show, which is outrageous. She's incredibly talented, but it's a unique night. And I set a scene in the book there, and I actually use Fabio and Maria, with their permission, in the novel. I also use the Calcio Storico. You know that event?
No, now you're educating us. I thought I knew a lot, but you're educating us more than anybody.
You guys, this is great. No, it's so funny how many people I know who've been to Florence and people who live in Florence who've never heard of the Calcio Storico. It's historic soccer. It's a event they have every spring in Piazza.
Is that the one where they beat the crap out of one another?
Yep, that's it. Okay. I covered it. It's in the book. It's insane. I covered it. I wrote about it for Maxim magazine like 4 years ago. I went over there on an assignment, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It's like rugby meets a barroom brawl meets mixed martial arts fighting meets a little bit of soccer kind of. It's basically like 29 guys? No, I can't remember how many are on the field at the same time. But it's just a bunch of guys. Like it's like a rumble game. It was invented by the Roman legionaries to sort of train for warfare. So the idea is to sort of encroach on the enemy's territory, with the ball being what you're carrying, and sort of get past all their defenses and over the wall, and you get points. And then in the meantime, people are just kicking the crap out of each other.
Sounds like a blast.
Yeah. It really is. And the fact that it still exists in this day and age, and that it exists in Florence, there's such a genteel city. But the idea is that the Renaissance wasn't about poetry only. They had to fight to get what they wanted. And this idea of like protecting your own and protecting your neighborhood is it still rings true. So the four neighborhoods of Florence all have a squad. They're all amateurs, but they're big and tough. And they mount this thing for free. The winning team gets a cow.
That's awesome. That's the best trophy ever.
It's amazing. I know. And they go at it. So I have a scene set in the Calcio Storico. I use a player who I befriended when I was there for my story, who's in it in real. So I guess the long story, I'm trying to make this answer shorter now that I'm talking on and on about it. But yes, I use lots of
people. It's a podcast. It doesn't
matter.
You can go as long as you want.
Oh, good. Good. And there's the character, the most important secondary character is this guy named Bill Guyon, who's a expat from Texas, and he's actually my friend Bill, and I didn't even change his last name because the character was so rooted in. I taught for a semester in Rome 3 years ago. I spent the summer at John Cabot University with some friends, and one of their friends is this guy expat named Bill, who became like my mentor. We were best. We spent every day together. My friends who brought me there were away for the summer. I stayed in their apartment, but Bill was like my guide, and we spent every day together. He's an amazing chef, caterer, tour guide there. And when I was making this character, I just it was so rooted in the real Bill. I couldn't even change his last name. So I just made it Bill Guyon, like based on Bill Guyon.
So, before we scheduled this podcast, you and I were just emailing back and forth, and I just want the listeners to know that Andrew and I were having this conversation. Hey, should I read the book before we do the interview? And I said, you know what? I don't want to read the book because I'll learn more and I, you know, sometimes, you know, you get the NPR interviews where everybody knows everything about the book, and it's almost like becomes this bantering back and forth of challenging your thinking or something. I'm like, I've learned, this is why I don't like reading the book before the interview, because you learn these great stories and dig in a little bit deeper, and you find maybe a little bit more meaning to stuff. So people can find the book, Amazon.com? Where else can they find the book?
Yeah, it's on all, you know, it's Amazon, it's Barnes and Noble, yeah. it's you know, your local bookstore will have it, I imagine, if you ask them to. I mean, it, you know, getting bookstores to carry books is you know, obviously a challenge because they're limited by space. But if you want to support your local bookstore, you can absolutely ask them to order it, and they'll have no problem getting a copy for you. Otherwise, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, any place you buy books online, it's readily available. I am hoping for an audio version at some point soon. And in fact, I would love an audio version. I think it would sound lovely to have someone, you know, who probably more articulate than I, read it.
Well, I think you should do
either
it.
Either way, it's okay.
I think you should read it. I think, you know, when I listen to audiobooks, I like, and I listen to a lot of Audible, I think you should read it, because I think it's hard for somebody to interpret your passion, your inflection, and your meaning. And I think you would be great at it, and I think it adds a little more, and I'm just giving my professional broadcast opinion because I've been a broadcaster the majority of my life, that I think I know when I listen to an audiobook that somebody's not personally invested into that, you know, and I think if you read it, I know it'd take an incredible amount of time, but I think you would connect to the listener a lot more. I really do, because I think your inflections would be more personal, if that makes any sense.
No, I'm with you, Travis. I think it's a good idea. I'll tell the publisher you said that.
Yeah, and we have a studio in my basement recording right now, so if you just want to come to Omaha, Nebraska, and sit here for a couple weeks, and I'll just record, you know, and we'll just drink wine every night and get lit up and have you record, and then it becomes even better.
I'm there. I mean, some steaks in Omaha and some Chianti Classico or whatever you got down there, that'd be great.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. So, you know, all your books are works of fiction. They revolve around food. Any plans for a nonfiction book?
That's a great question. Yes, because nonfiction sells better than fiction. It's tough. It's one of the realities of the modern age is that people read less and less fiction because of the distractions, the times in which we live, for sure. It's funny how, you know, some of my closest friends are like contacting me just this week. So I'm on chapter 9 of your book. I'm like, chapter 9, man, you've had this thing since October. What's going on here? The progress with reading fiction is diminishing. So from a commercial standpoint, I'm thinking nonfiction might be the path. I've written tons of nonfiction in short form journalism. I write for the New York Times. I write for Men's Journal. I've been in Rolling Stone, and you know, I do a lot of travel stuff. So I like the form of creative nonfiction, and I'd like to do something interesting about Italy, perhaps about food. I'd love to do some sort of broadcast stuff too, you know, TV stuff. I'd love, you know, if I was making my dream right now, it would be a, you know, my own Netflix show about eating Italy, or you know, whatever, something along those lines. But and I know that can be
it's been done
out,
by the way.
I'm sorry.
It's been done.
I heard that. Yeah. Yeah. But it seems to be an insatiable appetite for these things, too, though. I mean, I know there's tons of TV shows about Italy, and then you know, one just pops up. There's the one on Netflix now with Samin Nosrat,
yep.
You know, the fat acid.
Yes. Yes. We've watched
fabulous.
It.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, it was funny. That first episode I watched, the fat one set in Italy, I was watching it. Someone has said, you should watch this show. It's set, the episode set in Italy. There's a chef. She's really amazing. And I started watching it. I'm looking at her. I'm like, she looks familiar to me. And then I'm watching it more. And then she goes to that woman's house where they make the bolognese. Mm-hmm. They cook the sofrito and they make the bolognese together. Woman Benedetta. I was like, oh, my God, I know these people. When I was living there, one of the things I did to sort of immerse myself was I spent 2 weeks. I basically paid to work in a restaurant. And the restaurant was owned by this woman, Benedetta Vitale, who was the ex-wife of Fabio Picchi, the guy I was talking about earlier, the Cibreo guy. And I worked there, and there was this American, young American woman who was sort of my mentor because she spoke English, and she was training there, and it was Samin. And
really?
So we spent I spent 2 weeks under her wing in the restaurant all morning, cooking whatever was going to be on the menu for lunch. Then I'd go out to the dining room and sit down and be served that food. It was great. And she was really supportive and sweet. And she introduced me to Dario Cecchini.
Interesting. Andrew, I have one follow-up question. Cause Travis and I compete to ask the great questions, you know.
You're both doing really well.
Yeah, thank you. So here,
well, he's a lawyer and I'm a broadcaster, we ask questions for a living.
I'm stuck in the middle here. Yeah,
you are. You are. So, but here's where I'm intrigued. You've been all over Italy. You've lived there. You obviously feel it in your bones and you can write about it. And I know the food's key. If you were going to go back and live for another year, and I'm sure you will, what part of Italy would you live in?
That's a great question. I'm going back to Rome. We're tied right now.
Travis, no, he's up 2-1, you know, by the way.
You know, whoever buys the book first will be the winner.
Bought it last night.
Oh, there we go. I'm going back to teach in Rome, not this summer, but the following summer. I just created a program with the college I work at here in New York, LIM College in Manhattan. And they have a summer program in Florence right now. And I created a summer creative writing program that will go every June in Rome. So I'll be, as of 2020, I'll be in Rome every summer for the month of June. That being said, I am eager to do the I'm envious of those people who do that 6 months America, 6 months Italy existence, and I'm trying to, you know, make that part of my reality at some point. And if I had the choice to do that, where would I go? I think it would have to be Tuscany. I love Florence so much, and there's other places around that I really like. I'm becoming fascinated by, like Le Marche, for instance, where I spent some time last summer, and Abruzzo, which I spent some time in. But I want my central spot to be right there, like almost like dead center in the peninsula of Tuscany, and it would have to be outside the city. I love the city of Florence, and having access to it, but the countryside there is so spectacular. So somewhere in Chianti country, I would, you know, have a small place where I could live and, you know, and be very, very happy.
I think we have a lot of in common when it comes to our life goals of what we want to do. Some are set up better than others. But you need to help me with Pat, because he's a little more conservative than I am. I'm kind of like fly by the wheel of my pants. And
he's a lawyer.
He's a lawyer. Exactly. Because I found, you know, Tuscany, you're right. If I could stay in Tuscany, I would. But the truth is, Tuscany's pretty pricey compared to a lot of other regions. I found a villa the other day in Abruzzo, and I'm like, Pat, let's just buy it. It was like 245,000 euro. It was 3-story, had a pool, fully refurbished. I go, you're not going to find this in Tuscany. Let's buy it and just use it as a property to rent out during the season. If we want to go stay there, we can. And he's just like, I can't do it. He won't do it. Tell him he's wrong.
I'll do it with you. Forget Pat.
All right. Thank you.
Wait.
He can come visit.
Exactly. I'm like, because if, you know, we're all this about the same age, and I'm like, if we don't start making these decisions soon, we're just going to talk about them. And I don't want to be one of those guys that says, hey, we're going to just talk about it. I want to make sure we do it. I was at that funeral last night, and we had told somebody, well, our goal is to either own property there or live there half of the year. And they look at you like you're crazy. They're like, well, okay, that's a pipe dream. I go, no, that's a goal. And that I think a lot more people share that goal than we'll ever know of living somewhere else or just experiencing a culture like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, a lot of people have that romantic idea in their head, and then the actuality of it scares them off because it just seems, you know, too forbidden. But it's not that complicated to do. It certainly there's, you know, again, you know, you can buy a serious pad, you know, for what do you say, $250,000?
You know, yeah.
That's a studio in my neighborhood in Brooklyn. I mean, it that's like 500 square feet in Brooklyn. So, you know, the finances of it are much more amenable than people make them out to be. And you're right. You know, Tuscany is obviously real estate wise higher. And places like Abruzzo, Umbria, and Le Marche are crazy beautiful. Le Marche is amazing. I was in Ascoli Piceno for a few weeks last summer. My buddy from Rome married an Italian man, and they moved to Ascoli, where he was from, the Italian. And when I went there to visit him, they've been saying to me for years, you got to come visit, you got to write a story, you got to put this place on the map. And finally, I was like, fine, I'll come. And I went out there and was just blown away. It is California out there. It's rolling hills with amazing vineyards looking over the ocean. And it is dirt cheap.
Really? Dang.
Yeah. See? And you're on the Adriatic, and you can ski in 20 minutes inland, and you can go to be at the sea 20 minutes the other way. from Ascoli. And Ascoli is like Siena. It's about the size of Siena.
Okay.
It's similar in its culture. They even have one of those annual events. They don't have the palio. They have a jousting thing, which is really amazing. And it is just a great place to be. And close. You can get there from Florence in a couple hours.
You know, going back to your book, The Italian Adventure, is this one that could be made into a movie?
Oh, hell yeah.
So are you already trying to get this made into a movie?
When I was writing it, I'm like, this should just go to be a movie. And then now the book is out, and I'm a little soured on like how much potential can be sold, but copies, because people aren't reading that aggressively. The idea of the movie even seems more and more relevant. I'm getting tons of comments from people saying, this is so, you know, who would play, you know, Jacoby in the, that's the main character, who would play Jacoby in the movie? And I can't answer that question. I don't know any actors under the age of 45. So I'm like, I don't know. You know, somebody, you know, George Clooney in 1995, I guess. But there's interest in that. It's a very visual film, and like, and I like those films where, you know, they celebrate food, like Chocolat or Big Night,
exactly.
Eat, Pray, Love, to a certain extent. You know, I people have compared this to Eat, Pray, Love, and I'm like, well, it's more like Eat, Drink, Repeat.
You know,
Eat, Pray, Love. But you know, there's that aspect to it. Of course, the Italy thing and the food, and it's a very visual film.
When you describe I didn't mean to interrupt you, but when you describe it, it reminds me of A Male Under the Tuscan Sun.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking too. You know, it has that sort of, you know, and that's, I think that's unique. You know, and I'd hope that someone would recognize that and think, oh, we can, you know, we can make. I think, you know, not necessarily because if males aren't going there, then like why would males care? But I think that women want to see a male narrative in Tuscany, because it you know, it's interesting just to have a diversity of character, and I think that it is kind of a male under the Tuscan sun for sure.
Well, I'll offer my acting services, as limited as they are, as long as we can get Diane Lane to play in the film.
A great idea. I mean, there is that character of Helen, who there's lots of really great female characters in it too, so it would have a wonderful cast of females, and I think that we could have fun with the casting for sure once we sort of immersed ourselves in who the young actors and actresses are these days, because I don't know any of them.
How much would the story have to alter to be made into a movie? I mean, because when a book is translated into a movie, you've got to change it a little bit, either for conflict or something like that. How much would the story have to change from the book to a movie?
And if you don't think much at all.
Okay.
I mean, you're going to have to ask my lawyer, Pat, about this, because he's going to handle all the arrangements. But I don't think much would have to change at all. I mean, it's that's why people are saying that, oh, they got to make it into a movie, because it just translates perfectly. There's nothing. I mean, there's lots. You know, the hard part about taking a book into a movie, of course, is all that narrative where it's exposition. You know, it's not people doing or saying things; it's what they're thinking, and those things wouldn't necessarily interfere. You know, those moments wouldn't interfere so much with the plot line here. So I think there's enough visual stuff and enough action and enough, you know, really meaningful dialogue. And it's a great tour. There's so many, you know, it starts in the south of France, works its way down the Italian Riviera into Tuscany with stops in the city of Florence, with a trip out through Umbria and Le Marche. There's a great scene where he drives down to one of my favorite things to do in Tuscany is drive down and do Montepulciano, Pienza, and Montalcino. I know you guys have done that.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Several times.
Yeah. That road, I think, is just incredible. And you're starting in Montepulciano, drinking Vino Nobile, which is among my favorite Italian reds. And then you go to Pienza and have lunch. And then you go into Montalcino. Forget it. And he goes to Montalcino. Then he goes to the Forteza and drinks Brunello. And then goes down to the village where the Brunello was made and knocks on their door and buys a case of it and goes home.
All right, I have your next book, and maybe it could be made into a movie. Of course, it's already kind of been a movie in a different with Emilio Estevez and Martin Sheen. But why don't we? It's a book based on three guys who met via podcast and did The Way of St. Francis.
Perfect. Done.
So
let's do it.
We're not going to start in Canterbury, though. We'll start in Florence and then make our way to Rome. How's that?
Okay, that sounds great. I'm into it.
Oh, Andrew, that's great stuff. Andrew Cotto has been our guest on the Total Tuscany podcast. Cucina Tipica An Italian Adventure is the book. You can find it on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. Just go to your local bookstore and say, find the book, because from what we've heard today, it's going to be a fascinating read. And now that we've done the interview and I've got even more background on it, we are going to go read the book, Andrew.
Absolutely.
I love it. I appreciate you guys' time very much. It's great to connect with you and to meet fellow lovers of Tuscany and Italy. And we're going to have to vacation at some point together too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I would welcome it. And the odd thing about this podcast, and it never happens to us because it got really, you know, the first 57 episodes, you know, we're always looking for people to interview. And you reached out to us. I'm like, oh my God, somebody's heard of us. Somebody's like, hey, I know, I've heard of your podcast. Can I come on? That was like the highest form of flattery when you reached out to us, by the way.
Oh, hey, I'm here for you guys. And I wanted to just mention one last thing, is that I will be in Italy in May. My second novel, The Noir, is being translated into Italian right now, and it'll be published in Italy in March, and I'm going to go over on a tour in May. So if you guys are around then, I know when you guys are going. April?
We're going before Easter in April.
Before Easter, okay. So by May you'll be gone.
We'll be gone. But we're planning to go back in the fall, so we'll see.
The fall?
The fall, that's my best. That's my favorite time to go, too. December. So maybe we'll connect for a fall trip.
Sounds great.
Pat and I, we disagree on this because I do a radio show where I'm kind of booked all through the fall. So this last time I actually went to Florence December 1st through the 9th. And I got to be honest with you, I loved the Christmas season in Florence. I thought it was spectacular. And we got lucky because the weather was really good. It wasn't cold during that time. So I loved Christmas in Florence. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I saw all the lights they had hanging in Via Tornabuoni. That looked amazing.
Yeah, it was, and actually one of our good friends who lives over there, she said that Florence has never been decorated like that. It was like one of the first years they went all out, and it was like different on every street. So it was super, super cool. Andrew, always, go ahead.
No, I was gonna make another comment about like us visiting there, but we'll handle that later.
All right, we can put that together. Andrew, it's been a fascinating conversation. I think we should do it again because talk Italy. Anytime you get together, talk Tuscany, Italy, or even if you want to get in on an investment property without Pat, just me and you go in on this because Pat doesn't see the potential of it.
Pat can visit. Pat can definitely visit.
Yes.
Thank you.
But he has to rent it from us. He doesn't get it for free.
All right. You guys work that out.
All right. Andrew, thank you so much for your time. Excellent stuff. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Pat, I think people just got done with that interview and said that was male bonding at its finest.
That, you can't make that stuff up.
You can't.
No. And it's so interesting. We know it. We've lived it. People that haven't experienced it yet, they may be wondering, but the food does connect people, and it's kind of, and Italy's like a great equalizer. I'm listening to Andrew talk and I'm thinking, no matter where you come from, you get there and you start living that life and you start eating that food, and it really doesn't matter where you came from.
Okay, here's what we should do, because I just had a Netflix special come in my head. Because I told Andrew during the interview that, hey, a lot of that's been done before. You just do something on food. Here's a different way to do a Netflix show. And you can do it in Italy. You can do it really all over Europe. You can do it in the United States. If food is what bonds us, which I think it is, I think the best discussions, the best nights, even if it becomes political where you have discussions, is where you are around a table, not for an hour. That's the problem with America. We go, you know, restaurants need to turn the tables over. Restaurants want you in an hour and 15 minutes and out so they can bring somebody else in. I would love to do a Netflix show, and I shouldn't be giving this away on the podcast. I want to do a Netflix show where me, you, and Andrew now just go pick random people in cities and go to a table and have a spread and have conversations and get to know one another.
Conversations at the table.
Yeah. Table conversations with random strangers.
I only have one spin on that, Travis. Okay. I want that random table to be in Italy.
That's fine. We could start in Florence. We could go up to different parts of Italy where you have those random conversations. And then we've made so much money from the Netflix special. We go to France. We go to Germany. We just never come home.
And the great thing is we get to spend more time with our listeners and have them come meet us.
And so we do regular podcasts with that. But then the Netflix special is just eating around a table. And it could be a restaurant. It could be a home. But it has to be for like 3 hours in like 8 courses.
So if you're listening, Netflix, Yes. Contact us.
Andrew, if you like that idea, give me a call, because I think that is a different spin on food. That, you know, a lot of it is, hey, here's a restaurant, here's how it's prepared, here's where it came from. Let's talk about the uniting bond that is food, that brings it, and it is a common denominator between all languages, all cultures, all countries. And the truth is, when you sit around the table to break bread with somebody, that is one of the highest forms of just intimacy that I think you can share with
communion.
Somebody. Correct. Yeah.
Absolutely.
There you go. We just came up with $1 million idea, and somebody's probably going to steal it just from listening to this podcast.
If it helps people, great.
It's right. We're here to help the world, right? If you have not followed Total Tuscany on the social media channels, I highly encourage you to do so. You can follow us on our website. That would be TotalTuscany.com. You can also find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at Total Tuscany. And check out our Instagram page at Total Tuscany, where we share pictures and all sorts of things from our adventures to Tuscany. Of course, many of you know we run the Total Tuscany Experience. The Total Tuscany Experience dates for 2020 will be coming out soon. But if you have, you know, if you're going to Italy or you're going to Tuscany in particular and you need some advice or just need a little bit of help of planning, feel free to reach out to us. info@totaltuscany.com. We'll be happy to reach out to you, have a conversation with you, engage you, and try to point you in the right direction, because we want to make sure that if you do go to Tuscany, that it is a trip that you always remember and a trip that makes you want to come back again, again, and again. For Pat Campagna, I'm Travis Justice. Thanks for listening to the Total Tuscany Podcast. We'll see you next time. And remember, live, love, and eat like you're an Italian. We'll see you soon. Later. Ciao.